Hello and welcome. Before we get started with today's ADA audio conference session, we will do a sound check with our speakers. Lisa, would you please do a sound check?
Lisa?
Jan, would you do a sound check, please?
Jan?
And Mike, would you do a sound check for us, please?
Hello?
All right, very good. Kevin? Would you go ahead and please introduce today's session?
Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the question and answer session, Accommodating Students with Disabilities in Medical and Health Sciences Programs. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. If you require operator assistance during the program, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. I would now like to introduce this conference call, Mr. Peter Berg. You may begin.
All right. Thank you very much, Kevin. Welcome, everyone, to the May ADA Audio Conference session. This is a follow-up to our January session. Our speaker was gracious enough to rejoin us. We had a whole host of questions that we did not get to during that session. There was great interest, and we had a number of questions in addition submitted in advance by participants. As a reminder, this session is being recorded. We will post an archive of the session within 24 hours. For your information, the PowerPoint presentation that is being displayed in the webinar room will be posted when the archive of the session is posted. The handout that was available for you to download prior to today's session is not the presentation that is being used for the session. But just be aware that the handout will be available when the archive is posted. So you will have access to it. If you're in the webinar room, you can view the slides as our speakers present. And for those of you that are on the telephone, I apologize, but our speakers will describe and explain everything that is on the slides. And again, those handouts will be available when the archive is posted. The ADA Audio Conference Series is a project of the ADA National Network. The ADA National Network is funded by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Administration on Community Living, National Institute on Disability, Independent Living and Rehabilitation Research. You can locate the regional ADA center that serves your state by visiting adata.org. or by calling 1-800-949-4232. All right. Lisa, these questions were so great that we didn't get to last time, and the questions submitted in advance of today's session. Lisa reached out for some help and brought in with her a couple of colleagues that are going to introduce themselves in a moment here. But just as a reminder, Lisa Meeks is with the University of Michigan. You can find Lisa's full bio by visiting the ada-audio.org webpage, ada-audio.org, and select the link for speakers, and you will find a link to Lisa's full bio on that page. Okay, that's enough for me. We've got questions. We've got the information to share, and I'm going to turn it over to Lisa at this time. Lisa, it's all yours. Go ahead.
Great. Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be back with everyone today, and I appreciate so much the questions that were submitted. And I hope that we can give you the responses that you're looking for. And mainly, we really focused on giving you some resources so that you can find information to answer your questions, but also information that will help you with a myriad of questions down the road. You will notice that there are reference slides in between some of the Q&As, and those are for your benefit. We're not going to go over them. They're just articles or resources for your education. So all of you know me already because you were on the previous webinar, and so I will not take up any more of your precious time, but I want to have my colleagues who so graciously agreed to join me introduce themselves. Mike?
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you for the honor and opportunity to join today. So my name is Mike McKee. I'm an assistant professor. I'm not quite an associate professor, although I got promoted, so I'm excited about that. But that won't be official until later. But the other thing I just wanted to briefly just mention, I'm an assistant professor here at the Department of Family Medicine, and one of the key areas that we focus a lot is on disability health. So we are very interested in clinical as well as educational, community, and also research areas on this topic. This is obviously a topic dear to my heart. I am deaf. I have a bilateral sensorineural hearing loss, and I do have a cochlear implant on my right side, and also use a hearing aid on my left side. So I do have a personal experience with this topic, as well as also providing family medicine services for many different individuals, many of them with sensorineural hearing loss, as well as other sensory disabilities too. And I do have a number of projects that we focus on with disability health. But I'll stop there and let Jan introduce herself.
Thanks, Mike. So hello, everyone. And I'm also excited to be able to join Lisa and Mike on this call. And currently, I am the president for the Coalition for Disability Access in health science education, and I'm also an independent consultant with Meeks & Company Consulting. But a little bit about my background, most recently I was the director for disability services at the University of California, Irvine, and my work focused on students with disabilities in the schools of nursing and pharmacy and medicine, and I also was a contributor to the coalition book, The Guide to Assisting Students with Disabilities, Equal Access in Health Science and Professional Education, and focused on the chapters on accommodations. And just to say a little bit more about my background, I started off as a special education teacher back in 1989, and that was probably where some of my greatest experience came. But when I came to UCI as the director of disability services, I was really struck with how different it is working with students in the schools of nursing and medicine and other health sciences. So I'm so glad that we have this opportunity to look at your questions and give you some information so that you don't have to struggle through like I did. And I'll turn it back over to you, Lisa.
Great. So let's get started. Mike?
Yeah, so I will be reviewing most of these questions, and Lisa and Jan will be doing most of the discussions, but there will be certain areas where I'll jump in. So with that being said, the first question that we received was, are there any accommodations specific for people with developmental disabilities, mainly for individuals with high-functioning autism? And Lisa?
So we'll go to the next slide, and I'll take that one, Mike. So when we look at individuals who are on the autism spectrum, we can't specifically say that there are accommodations or barriers that they're automatically going to experience. But there has been a good deal of research on some of the top barriers. And so I want to hit a few of those. So the first one you see is executive function and lack of cognitive flexibility. Well, I'm sure you're well aware of executive functioning deficits, things like time management, organizational skills. But lack of cognitive flexibility is more on the ability to transition or switch from one concept to another. And we know that many students on the autism spectrum are not very quick in making that quick adjustments or transitions. So that's one big barrier. Another one is that many of these students on the spectrum are not comfortable, or they fail to seek out help when they when they need it, or even accepting help when it's offered. And so pre-planning with students and getting good feedback from them is really important to identify if this is one of the barriers. Also, if you've worked with students on the spectrum, you know that frequently faculty are sometimes uncomfortable. They pick up right away that the student is awkward and maybe socially different than many students. And a lot of times they see students as on the spectrum as being condescending towards them or even aggressive. And these are areas that students on the spectrum really don't recognize about themselves. And so it can really create a huge wall between them and their supervisors or them and their peers. Of course, the awkward interactions with patients is also another barrier that students might experience. And it's really helpful to have accommodations to training in working and alleviating that. And then finally, probably the one that is most relevant is that students on the spectrum don't pick up those social norms and those unwritten rules, much like many students with ADHD as well, that they're not picking up things inferentially, and so they don't adhere to the norms and courtesies and unwritten rules that the rest of us follow as almost without thinking. Next slide.
So if you know me or you've heard me talk, you'll hear me go back to the core competencies and technical standards. And I think it's important, I'm just going to start here with the accommodations. It's important for you to understand what your technical standards say and what the core competencies say about professionalism, communication, and behavior. This is an excellent tool to use when sitting down with students on the autism spectrum to make them aware of the expectations that one would have. For example, in the domain, and these are just taken from randomly from health science school, but in the domain of professionalism, this reads, students should maintain and display ethical and moral behaviors commensurate with the role of a physician in all interactions with patients, faculty, staff, students, and the public. The students expected to understand the legal and ethical aspects of practice of medicine and function within the law and ethical standards of the medical profession. So if you have a student on the spectrum who disagrees with a protocol or a specific procedure that is a hospital-based procedure, and it is partially guided by the law and or professional associations, this is one way to bring them back to the point of professionalism. So reviewing the student code of conduct and the communication and professionalism domain helps, and it helps when you're in the moment with a student, when a student maybe has had a mishap, but it is also really helpful for those of you who know that you're working with a student on the spectrum to address these things in advance with the student. So another way to look at this is to bring the student in and do some self-awareness assessment. Does the student have self-awareness of their behaviors or their interactions with people? Review those professionalism standards and competencies. This is another great way to work with students on the autism spectrum, would be to review a clinical skills exam as a model of patient interaction. So all health science programs perform clinical skills exams, and the majority of those health science programs, regardless of the program, actually videotape these interactions so that they can, one, assess them, and two, go back and work with the student if necessary. It would be really helpful if you were to identify a clinical skills exam that was an exemplar of a student interacting with a patient, and then to put side by side the exemplar video and the actual student who's on the spectrum, their video, and to walk them through step by step, pointing out the areas that were difficult for the student. Another approach is to remediate clinical exams or clinical skills in a simulation lab or with standardized patients. So SPs standing for standardized patients. So in this scenario, you might work with the student on his or her interpersonal skills with patients, and then go back and assess these through another standardized patient exam, or to actually run the remediation. And so, you know, helping the student perfect their skills with an actual SP. Something that's really important for students on the spectrum is to have in vivo or real-time feedback. When a student on the spectrum does a clinical skills exam and doesn't get feedback for 2 weeks, it's not really helpful in changing a behavior or even understanding the behavior. So working with the student and giving real-time or in vivo feedback is super important. You can also work with a vocal coach or a simulation center director. These individuals have specialized skills, usually in acting and or articulation. As you know, so often students on the spectrum may have difficulty in kind of the way that they talk, if it's very monotone, and they can work with a vocal coach or the sim director on improving the intonation as they interact with patients. And then near peer coaching. And what I mean by that is to take someone who is advanced in your program and a student that does really well in patient interaction and have them serve as the standardized patient and give the feedback to the student who is struggling. Another potential accommodation or intervention is to take the student to the clinical site in advance of them starting the rotation there or starting the clerkship there, and to have them orient to both the clinical site and the electronic health records. Again, individuals on the spectrum have difficulty with change, as Jan pointed out. And so this may be a mechanism for reducing kind of the newness of the site location and of the electronic health records. Practice presenting rounds. Even disability service providers can practice presenting rounds with a student on the spectrum. You don't have to be a nurse or a PT or a physician to be able to do this. You can actually ask your simulation center for some retired cases, and then you can work with the student on those facial expressions, intonation, things of that nature. Developing a badge that has an outline of how you report patients has been highly effective with students on the spectrum. So you would just make a printout of the order in which you would report or present a patient, and then you would reduce it to the size of the name badge that the student wears every day and attach it to the same type of holder that the student already uses for their name badge. Students on the spectrum may also benefit from a reduced number of patients on the ward for a limited time. So what you're doing in essence is ramping up the patient load. The student on the spectrum, if the patient panel is normally 5 for a student on a particular ward, you may start out with 3 patients and have the student work and get comfortable with those 3 patients in the first week, add a 4th patient in the second week, and then ramp up to that 5th patient. Now, I know what all of you are thinking. That sounds great, but these students have to do the same amount of patient care as others. Well, that is easily remedied by having the student actually rotate perhaps on a Saturday or a Sunday and see 1 or 2 patients on those days to make up for the clinical interaction that is lost in reducing their patient load during the week. Noise-canceling headphones are also really beneficial for students on the spectrum to wear in downtime. A lot of times there's downtime when they are charting their patient or in between patient care or waiting for lab results to come in, and being able to wear these noise-canceling headphones is highly beneficial in reducing the amount of sensory stimulation that the student is experiencing during the day. We already talked about in vivo feedback in a simulated setting, but that also is highly effective in a real-world setting. So having a coach, perhaps a preceptor or a life coach or an ADHD coach, a lot of times you can find individuals that work with the ADHD population that can also be helpful for students on the spectrum. And having someone follow the student for a portion of the day and give real world feedback. For any of you that have worked with students on the spectrum, you know how critical that instant feedback is to correcting behavior. Video modeling, and that's what we talked about in the simulation, to put up a video model of the student on the spectrum side by side with a exemplar student. And I would advise you to choose a student that is not in the same class as the student on the spectrum or within a year or two. You want to draw from someone that is historical so that that student doesn't feel like they're being compared to a real life, in real life peer. And then minimizing switching clerkship sites. This has been really, really helpful for me. I think the two most helpful things for me when working with medical students on the spectrum has been to have that in vivo feedback and also to minimize switching clerkship sites. So to situate the student at a hospital or a clinical site and to keep them there for as many rotations as you possibly can, because they become acclimated to the environment and they're used to working within that system. It really helps alleviate some of the kind of external noise that can be detrimental to a student. And I'm going to turn it over to Jan.
Thanks, Lisa. We'll go to the next slide. So let's talk about some additional accommodations. Having an assigned mentor that meets with a student once a week can be really helpful, especially if you don't have a coach, a life coach or an executive coach to work with the student. And this person can help to review feedback that the student has been getting, work on things like social norms or role play. I know that many students are hiring executive coaches to work with them on some of the higher skills, and that's also something to be considered. But definitely a mentor can help with the hidden curriculum and be direct about the expectations that are in those core competencies. They can also provide scripts. You can provide scripts for addressing when they're addressing their attendings or other residents. And definitely getting that feedback in writing is so helpful. In my experience, students on the spectrum really memorialize things so much better when they see them in writing. So when you give feedback or when students are getting feedback on the wards, do it in writing. Make sure you correlate it back to the clinical competencies and measures where they may not be be so successful. And then again, pointing out any new information that is coming in regards to feedback of any deficits, and then providing some good examples, some clear examples of how they could remediate, whether it's through video modeling or taking notes on how someone else is doing that type of procedure or presentation. And then a final possibility for an accommodation is allowing the student to have a little bit of release time from the wards so that they can keep on top of their own health and wellness. Next slide, please. And Lisa, I think that's you.
Oh, sorry. So this is a sample badge. I talked to you earlier about making up a badge for presenting patients and having it attached to the name badge. And so this would be an example of what one might look like. So this says key features of presentation, opening one-liner, describe who the patient is, number of days in hospital, and their main clinical issues, 24-hour events. And then it goes on to work through the way that you would present a patient. The caveat to this, I would say, is that different attendings and different nurse managers and different preceptors might want the patient reported out differently. So again, working with the student as you rotate through the clerkships or the rotations to make sure that this badge, the sample badge, is in line with what the particular preceptor is looking for. And then I think also Jan did a great job of, you know, talking about how when you're working with individuals on the spectrum, it's really important to have visuals. So whether it's, you know, the student is not meeting a clinical competency, to have that in writing to show them exactly which competency they're not meeting. But also, and this goes back to the kind of condescendingness that we hear so much about, you know, the student corrects the faculty member, is to help the student understand a kind of an abstract concept like a hierarchy. And when you make rules for individuals on the spectrum, they tend to follow them. They tend to understand or at least adopt them and follow them. So this is just a visual that shows how medical students are kind of at the bottom of the barrel when it comes to hierarchy and how it goes up to interns and junior residents and senior residents and so forth. And so just helping the student understand where they lie on the hierarchy and developing some sort of social rule about correcting individuals and how important that is. So I know we spent a lot of time on that one question. We're not going to spend quite as much time on each question, but I know from personal experience that I get a lot of emails and Jan gets a lot of emails around working with students on the autism spectrum. So we really wanted to take a deeper dive into that. For those of you who subscribe to Disability Compliance for Higher Education, there is an article in there written by a student, partially by a student on the spectrum. And so that's a great resource for you. So next question.
Before we go to the next question, I just wanted to also highlight that this topic is very pertinent to other students who have different types of disabilities, not just with the autism spectrum disorder. So personally, for me, I know Jan and Lisa mentioned a couple strategies that were very useful for me. Obviously, reviewing clinical skills, doing these mock video modeling is helpful, especially as you incorporate an interpreter or another person that can help with any communication. And the same thing is remediating any critical skills. So for me, it was actually practicing with an amplified stethoscope with an assigned mentor and faculty member. So I just wanted to highlight that these are very overlapping themes and strategies that can help a number of people.
That's really helpful, Mike, because we had a speaker at our annual symposium, Chad Ruffin, and he is a deaf physician, and he talked about how some of the same things that might be barriers for individuals on the spectrum could be barriers for individuals that are deaf or hard of hearing because they're spending so much cognitive energy trying to attend to either an interpreter or a captioner. And sometimes if they're not hearing everything, things get lost in translation. And so it may come off as a social deficit when it's kind of a secondary deficit to the primary disability of, you know, not being able to hear everything or not being able to pick up on, you know, the change in intonation of somebody's voice. So I think that's a really good point. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. So we're going to go on to the next question. And the second one we have is, are medical licensing boards held to the same standards? Specifically, some medical schools accommodate disabilities under the ADA only to have the medical boards deny them. How is this possible?
Great question. And we'll try not to go too much in the weeds. I'm going to share with you, and this is a brand new slide. I've never really talked about this, but I really thought about this question. So whoever submitted it, thank you so much. And I want to point out kind of what I see as the top issues that result in a denial, because we actually, you know, counter to the assumption that the medical boards turn down a lot of students, we have actually, Jan and I both have had a really high success rate. I think my success rate was kind of 98 point something percent of getting accommodations, and Jan's was almost equally as high. But when we're approached about, you know, someone who did not get accommodations, there are a few themes that, you know, kind of emerge, and those are failure to follow directions. So oftentimes we see students who submit a form and they have not followed the directions. A good example is students in medicine, and I'm going to defer to medicine because really the NCLEX and some other boards, we really don't have a lot of issues with those boards. They do a good job of accommodating and approving students. So I'll just talk about the medical boards for now, but this is applicable, you know, certainly to everything. That they don't submit their MCAT scores, and you have to submit your MCAT scores. But if you don't read the directions in, you know, kind of summary, then you might not pick that up and you might not send them in. And that could deter your application for up to 60 days, you know, with the medical boards having to come back and ask for new information. The second one is failure to make a timely request. So if you get rejected and you want to appeal your decision, you're going to need a lot of time. You know, the boards say 60 days, but it could run anywhere from 60 to 120 days in actuality. So being, you know, submitting your application, I would say far, far in advance, at least 120 days in advance is critical, because if you do get a rejection and you need to appeal and respond to their reasons for denial, you're going to need extra time. And so a lot of students time out. They run up against entering the wards. And if you don't have, and it depends, a lot of schools are switching their curricula now where students will take the step one at the end of year three. But if you're still in a curricula that maintains taking step one at the end of year two before you can go into the wards, you may actually not be able to continue in your education until you have a passing step one score. Well, you can't have a passing step one score if you don't take the step one exam. So if you fail to make a request in a timely manner, you may be sitting in a situation where you are forced to either take the exam without accommodation or take a leave of absence or defer entry into the clinical setting by up to 3 months just to go through the appeal process. Number three, failure to address exam-specific barriers. So I see a lot of applications where students say, you know, I have ADHD, and so I need extra time. That alone, a diagnosis alone, is not going to warrant accommodations on the NBME or any other board exams. You need to talk about the functional impairment that is a result of the disability and keep it very specific to that. In kind of the counterpoint is that you also need to keep it specific to the exam. So it's not just you have a functional limitation, but how do you have a functional limitation on this specific exam? What is it about the exam setting? What is it about the exam format? What is it about the exam time or the way the questions are presented that causes a barrier for your particular functional limitation? If you do not approach the request in the way of functional limitation and exam-specific barrier, you won't be approved because they specifically ask for that information. Number four, failure to provide evidence of functional limitation when compared to the average person standard. So many of you might know this and some of you may not, but the medical boards are looking at the average person standard, and I'm going to go into a little bit more of that in the next slide, so I'll hold my comments for that next slide. Number five, poorly constructed personal statements that work against the student. I've seen several personal statements that say things like, it would be helpful if, I would benefit from, even though I have a disability, I overcame. All of those things are essentially saying, I don't need accommodations, that it would be beneficial. Well, a lot of people might argue that something would be beneficial, but is it necessary to have equal access to the exam? These are the type of word switches that need to be made. It's not beneficial, it's absolutely necessary. It's not, it would be helpful if, it's mandatory that I have this extra time or whatever to be able to access this particular exam. And the reason is because the exam is constructed, you know, X, Y, Z. And never overcome. It's you know, if a student says that they have overcome their disability, then they are not a person with a disability, and therefore they do not need accommodations. So just to be really careful, and if you're able to help your students, I know that I was, you know, I was in a wonderful situation where I had the benefit of time to work individually with each student on their personal statement, and I was able to really give critical feedback. But if you can at all, there is a, on the Coalition website, so www.hsmcoalition.org, there are some student resources under the resources tab, and one of those is a NBME accommodations packet, and it talks about all of the things that I'm talking about now, the use of language, you know, how you present the barrier. So I would at the very least share that with your students. And then the failure of the school to provide adequate assistance. If you have a student with a disability, it's likely that they may be struggling just to get through the curricula. And if they wait until second year or, you know, the end of second year as they're getting ready to move to the wards, there are a lot of exams, there's a lot of pressure, there's a lot of things going on that they have to do, and it may be a really poor time to then be working on something that could take up to 10 to 12 hours. I would equate the applying for accommodations on the NBME to applying to medical school. You know, maybe not as far, but you need to spend a good amount of time on this. And so schools need to be telling students from day one, you need to be working on this right away, straight away, year one. If you have, you know, updated documentation that you need to get that settled now. You need to work on your personal statement now. Just another caveat that's not in here is that, and thank you so much for putting the website on there, is that some of the, you know, talking in a personal statement about your barriers, students are used to highlighting their strengths. You only talk about the barriers in this personal statement, and to do that could have some psychological effects, to be quite frank. And so as students are going through this, they might also be processing kind of what they have been going through and processing their identity as a person with a disability. So it may be difficult to get through this, and it may take more time. So programs need to be really proactive in working with students on this. Jan?
Thanks, Lisa. So Lisa talked quite a bit about the student's role in applying for those accommodations. But there's a flip side, and we hope that you will be helping your students by writing a letter of support. And so when you're doing that, again, this is a process that would take me quite a bit of hours, at least 10 hours to put together a really good, strong argument or a good letter in support of the student getting accommodations. So what are the three key points? So you really want to make sure that it's clearly written that the student is actually a person with a disability. And so as you write this letter, you want to refer to the identified diagnoses and the specific areas of deficit, the functional limitations, and you want to show how that they are so much, they are far below the average person standard. So when we look at standard scores and T scores, we know that the average person on a standard score is 100 or 85 to 115. And so when a person comes up with a reading score of 85 or 86, we know we're going to provide accommodations for that student. But the NBME is looking at that person as, well, yeah, they may have a very high IQ score, but their reading is still in the average range. And so you want to make sure that you point out to students if their scores are not severe in the severely disadvantaged area of like 25 to 30 percentile, you know, they may automatically not be able to get accommodation. So they may need updated documentation or more thorough documentation in a specific area such as reading. You also want to show their history of disability, when they were first identified. Definitely use numerical data and their history of accommodation. The next part in your argument is relating the disability and relating the disability barrier to the exam. And so if you don't know what the exam looks like, you really need to go to NBME website and look at sample questions. Look at how they set up the daily schedule for the 8-hour exam. When are the breaks? And so that you know how the questions are formatted. You know what the graphics and the visuals look like or how the vignettes are set up. And that it isn't just like 3 or 4 multiple choices. Usually it's like there's 8 multiple choice answers. And they're not just a quick answer. They're small passages that a person has to get to. So you really want to be able to look at the functional limitation and directly relate it to the exam, the barrier that exists in the exam. And then finally, you really want to make a case for reasonable accommodations and the reasonableness of it.
Jan?
And, yes.
This is Peter. We're getting some feedback on your phone. I don't know if at times you're coming in perfectly good, and then other times there's a little bit of feedback, like you're moving. I don't know if.
I'm not moving. I'm being.
Okay.
I am moving a little bit.
Now you sound great.
Okay. So I'm not sure where to pick up, but I'll start with the third. Notation of making sure that you explain or you're making the case for how this accommodation is reasonable and that it will allow the student to be able to demonstrate mastery of their medical knowledge. So again, pointing back to the barriers that exist within the exam, the only way that you're going to know that is by really taking a look at how those exams are set up. And hopefully that hits everything that I was pointing to. Next slide, please.
So Jan talked about the average person standard, and what I have here is a picture of psychological testing normal distribution. And I think where a lot of disability service providers kind of miss the mark is in thinking that because there is a discrepancy using the discrepancy model, as Jan described, the student has a high IQ but may have a lower score in reading. And because they also carry a diagnosis of perhaps reading disorder or something of that nature, that they will automatically qualify for accommodations on the exams. However, they're not going to. So what I tell people is that I have a yellow arrow that's kind of pointing to one standard deviation below the mean. And what I tell individuals is that if your student score is not below that, which is 85 for a standard score or 15.9%, 16%, something like that, if it's not below that score, your student is in the average range. And because your student is in the average range, they're likely not going to qualify for accommodations on board exams. And there are some references that you can see here. I wanted to give you there's a full 1-hour webinar on this topic that you can go to. The link is there. And there's also Jan talked about building your argument and giving a support letter. In the Guide to Assisting Students with Disabilities Equal Access, that first reference, there is a guide to help providers build that letter. So you can check out those resources. Mike?
Thank you, Lisa. That was super helpful. Also, again, just really highlighting the key here is preparation, just addressing any needs early on. Again, those are things that are really going to help with the student's success. And then the other thing is just really recognizing how much extra effort students with different types of disabilities have to do in order to overcome some of these obstacles or even coordinating accommodations. We had one article that touched on deaf or hard of hearing students, medical and health professional students. We're actually spending several hours a week just trying to coordinate that. So it's important to recognize their efforts. So our next question is, when examining documentation of disabilities and or accommodations, should there be a time limit on that documentation? For example, some schools have no limits, while others won't accept documentation older than 3 years.
Thanks, Mike. This is one of those situations where we always say it depends. But if you go back to thinking about what is really the purpose of documentation, it's really twofold. First of all, you need it to determine eligibility, that the student is eligible for accommodation. So that's first and foremost what you need. Secondly, you also want that documentation to be able to identify the barriers or the functional limitations that the student is going to experience in the didactic or the clinical environment. So having the most current documentation is really helpful. Especially when a student has a disability that is episodic in nature, like migraines or fluctuating, like a mental health condition. So you personally may want to have documentation that is as current as possible, and you may want, every year, you may want to get some updated documentation. But then again, when we have more static-like disabilities or disabilities that students are acquire very early in life, such as deafness or hard of hearing, low vision, mobility, you may not need that proof. And having something from an old IEP or an old documentation isn't the issue, because you can see the disability and you know it's lifelong. Next slide.
Thank you, Jan. So our next question is, what are some accommodations for color blindness?
Great. I love this topic. My first year at UCSF, I had 10 students that had CVD or color vision deficiency. And so I very quickly had to ramp up my knowledge of CVD. And we wound up writing some articles that are listed in the reference section. But I think first and foremost, it's important as health science disability providers for you to understand that 1 in 5 males has CVD. So the chances are pretty high that you will have someone that has CVD, or as we say colloquially, they're colorblind. So I think one way to approach it is just an awareness and a screening. You can provide a CVD statement to incoming medical students or incoming, health science students to build awareness, saying something like color blindness or color vision deficiency is a common condition that can affect your ability to detect certain clinical indicators. If you believe you have CVD, please alert your instructor. Instructors and students can work to craft appropriate strategies for the didactic and clinical settings. Students who suspect they have CVD but are uncertain can undergo CVD screening with student health. So being able to provide free and confidential screening for CVD is really helpful. In the classroom and laboratory, using black font for all classroom presentations is really important. Having special items notated with arrows, or using numbers or letters versus color. A lot of times people will color code things instead, and this is more universal design kind of approach. Using numbers and letters would be helpful. Use green laser pointers. One of the first things that I did was, most laser pointers are red. I actually had to order all green laser pointers for our faculty. In the gross anatomy lab, what we did was provide high-quality grayscale prints alongside each microscope, and we did this for every student. So regardless of whether you had CVD, you had access to a high-quality grayscale print of the slides. And students were able to have the slides also transitioned to high-quality grayscale to study from that, so that they would be studying the same type of figure that they would be tested on. And making assistive technology available for students with CVD, you can do colored overlays. There are specialized glasses that help with CVD. Color converting software programs. that will help turn things to grayscale, high quality grayscale. And using alternative color staining in your specimens. So not using red or green, but using another type of stain to do this. And then for the clinical setting, using reflectance meters when reading test strips. So instead of having to look for a scale of red, I'm trying to think of the tests that have the strips that are red, and I can't remember, but it's a urine test. And then cross-checking with colleagues for color-dependent diagnoses. So that might be, you know, the ability to detect fresh blood from old blood. And that's very important in making a diagnosis at times. Also, when looking at an ear, deciding whether or not a child, for example, has an ear infection. Focus on the shade versus the color. So again, transmitting things to high quality grayscale and focusing on shade. And making sure that you're taking a really good patient history and report of symptoms is just one other way to triangulate your diet, your differential in a clinical exam and for observations. And then utilizing apps, applications on cell phones now for low and high black and white contrast in conjunction with some devices. So there are a couple of things out there that I talk about a lot. I am absolutely in love with the CellScope. One reason I love the CellScope so much, which is an adapter for an iPhone to use as an otoscope, is that, and we talked about that actually in the original webinar. So if you didn't see the original webinar, I'd encourage you to go back and look at that. One of the great things about the CellScope is when you are doing an examination of a child's inner ear, you can use an app to turn that color to high contrast grayscale so that you can have a more accurate diagnosis. And in the references, you'll see that there are some articles that talk about the different things that you can do to support students, again, in the guide to assisting students. And then there are quite a few articles, actually, that were written on this topic that you can pull up and go to for more information. Mike?
Thank you. So our next question that we received is an example, what is an example of technical standards that could be considered for nursing programs? So next slide. So this is a topic that many of us struggle with, especially with technical standards that could be perceived as discriminatory. So obviously the technical standards are in place to help different institutions, different training programs, to help to see or judge the qualifications and eligibility before they matriculate into the program. What I wanted to highlight is that technical standards can actually be broken up into two different categories. So there's an organic version of the technical standards, which is what we perceive to be very restrictive. These are generally deficit-based. So using myself as an example, a organic technical standard would ask, am I able to hear? And this is not with accommodations. So if there was a restrictive technical standards, I would not be eligible for that program. That would contrast with a functional technical standard, which is what I consider to be much more progressive and more current. And these are based on abilities with or without accommodations. So am I able to do the job? And in my situation, if I were to use an amplified stethoscope, would that allow me to do the job of being able to listen to heart sounds and lung sounds? And in that case, I would. So I wanted to make sure people were aware of those two different categories of technical standards. So I want to be mindful of the time. So let's go to the next slide. So obviously, as I mentioned, schools are, we need to make sure that they don't impose or apply eligibility criteria that are going to be discriminatory or screen out individuals with disabilities. Many of them are unintentional, but I would encourage you to just review your technical standards. Some of you might be surprised on some of the language that's used. And so it's important that we need to periodically review these technical standards to make sure that they're current and not discriminatory. Next slide. So we put a slide here to provide what we consider a discriminatory technical standard. So communication, a candidate should be able to speak, to hear, and to observe patients in order to elicit information, describe changes in mood, activity, posture, and perceived nonverbal communications. A candidate must be able to communicate effectively and sensitively with patients. Communication includes not only speech, but reading and writing. The candidate must be able to communicate effectively and efficiently in oral and written form with all members of the healthcare team. So that would be an example of a discriminatory technical standard. If it was an individual, say it was a deaf individual using a sign language interpreter, the use of language of speech and oral would automatically be discriminatory to that particular student. So we're going to give an example of what we consider to be a better written technical standard. And in this case, some language was changed here, where now students should be able to communicate with patients in order to elicit information, detect changes in mood, activity, and to establish a therapeutic relationship. It's really about the ability to care and manage for patients. And so if they are able to do it with and without accommodations, that should be the focus. Students should be able to, we'll go back. So in this one here, students should be able to communicate by English effectively and sensitively with patients and all members of the healthcare team, both in person and writing. So the in-person, instead of being oral and written, it does allow some flexibility in order to communicate effectively with the patients and the healthcare team. So next slide. So there's obviously a number of strategies that we encourage you to do. The first thing is I would encourage you to go to your institution's technical standards. They're not easy to find, so that certainly poses a problem, especially for students that are interested in applying to your program. Many of them are trying to locate it, and if it is difficult to find, you may want to actually mention it to different folks to put it in a better position or a better place in the website. The other thing is you want to make sure that you highlight the what, not the how, as well as providing directions on how to request accommodations. You want to be upfront that we're not trying to focus on the deficit, but really with accommodations, focus more on the ability of the students. And then making it more welcoming for students with disability, and it's really about the principles that with diversity and inclusion, we want to have a diverse healthcare workforce, and one way to do that is to make sure that we also address our technical standards and make sure it's not discriminatory. And then the other thing is all technical standards should be met with or without accommodation. And that is going to be a case-by-case basis, but it's important to highlight that they can make these requests. And then lastly, students should sign an attestation each year that they have reviewed this. Next slide.
So this is an example of some technical standards. Right now, Rush is kind of leading the pack, although many schools are changing their standards, including Michigan, to be more approachable. But this is a snapshot of the Rush website, and the reason I chose to share a snapshot of Rush was because many of you come from a myriad of different programs, and Rush has several health science programs, so you could find an example on each. But I wanted to read just a portion of their opening statement, and it says, Rush actively collaborates with students to develop innovative ways to ensure accessibility and creates a respectful, accountable culture through our confidential and specialized disability support. Rush is committed to excellence and accessibility. We encourage students with disabilities to disclose and seek accommodations. Now, I think I would be hard-pressed to find, you know, a school that is that good. They've done an excellent job of communicating how committed they are to having a workforce that mirrors that of their patient population, and that includes individuals with disabilities. there are some references, and you'll see that I believe Mike McKee is on some of these papers, but the these are some references to papers on technical standards, and the Kezar paper is med-ed focused, and the Ailey paper is nursing focused, and so just a few references for you.
And Lisa, just as a reminder, we have about 30 minutes left in the session.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. So our next question that we received, are essential functions the same as technical standards? The next slide. So these are really considered to be the same as core competencies, and what we're trying to do is now think about a student who's already been matriculated and looking to see if they are qualified to do the job and move on after they did the enrollment and move on to their extra levels of training, or they want to go ahead and look for employment. And so these are really based on knowledge, skills, and abilities that a student has to demonstrate. So in my case, in family medicine, I need to be able to care and manage health conditions of different ages, going from newborn up to older ages. And so we have a wide variety of core competencies that we have to demonstrate and be able to tackle. So next slide, please.
So again, technical standards before, and essential requirements or core competencies after. So the essential requirements should communicate the what of an educational experience. These are things you learn when you're in the program. And every program should be making these transparent, should have a list of everything that needs to be learned. So what must the student know? What has to translate to practice? What does the student have to be able to perform? What procedures? Like Mike said, you know, in family medicine, you go from infants, newborns to geriatric patients. And then what just has to be observed? So in a lot of the programs, the student just has to have an experience with a core competency. And the core competencies should be clear, concise, and importantly, they should be measurable so that you can have objective measures across all students, not just students with disabilities. And behavioral expectations should be part of the competency and should also be measurable. You should be able to map a core competency onto an actual practice. So you couldn't say, for example, in a nursing program, you must be able to stand on your head for 30 seconds. It makes absolutely no sense in, you know, when you go out into the employment world. So you have to be able to map these on actual practice or some sort of accreditation and employment thing. Next.
Thank you. So our next question is, what other professional resources are available to help identify software, hardware, special tools, or techniques and strategies that might be considered for reasonable accommodations? So we just briefly provided some examples here with the Job Accommodation Network, Coalition, the Listserv, and the Guide, Occupational Therapists, as well as AT Specialists. There are a number of other groups, so depending on the students, in terms of what type of disability they may have, there may be organizations that are specific to their type of disabilities. So in my example, I work closely with the Association of Medical Professionals with Hearing Loss, and we will have an upcoming conference in Baltimore on June 1 through 4. This is an organization that obviously has a lot of resources, networking opportunities, advocacy for students that have hearing loss. Next slide. So our next question is in private or for-profit medical schools, do they only consider the operating budget of the school itself, such as endowments or projected income? Next slide.
Great question. So any school that receives federal dollars is subject to the ADA. And while there are minor differences in a public versus a private school, it's mostly centered on the preference for type of accommodation if all of the accommodations would provide equal access. It's not really focused on the cost or the funding, but we're going to defer to your legal counsel on the budget. And so I would suggest that whomever asked the question or anyone struggling with this type of question go to their legal counsel. I do want to note that Creighton University in the Argeni Creighton case was a private Jesuit university and could not argue undue burden in that Argeni case, and the cost of accommodations was upwards of $250,000. So do keep that in mind.
Thank you. So our next question is, are there examples of recommended language to include in notes to students or preceptors about their responsibilities?
So I'm going to defer to the UCSF website because it maintains language for both students and faculty. And I think that they do a really good job, and they post, this is a snapshot of the UCSF webpage, and they post all of their policies and procedures on their website, and it has really good guidance for preceptors and students. And if the website does not contain what you're looking for, I would encourage you to reach out to their SDS office, because they really do have lots and lots of examples that they would be happy to share with you.
Thank you. And this, again, highlights the importance of allowing opportunities for students with different types of disabilities to meet future preceptors. Many of the preceptors often may not have experience working with these students, and so having that interaction early on can be really critical to identify any specific areas in which accommodations might be needed. So our next question, was the interpreter required at Johns Hopkins for disability, and then put parentheses, like hearing, or for language barrier? So the quick answer is obviously this was based on hearing. This is mainly because this particular nursing, this is actually a nurse who is deaf. She was not able to access language or information in other ways. So this was under the hearing loss or disability, not language barrier. So our next question. So are there any accommodations or assistive equipment for severe stuttering? And the answer is yes, and then we'll provide some more information. Jan?
I think that's Lisa. Oh, okay.
Oh, Lisa,
so that's okay. Lisa, do you want to take that one?
Yeah.
Refer to the articles? Okay.
As I said in the beginning of the webinar, we are going to point you to a lot of resources because there were lots of questions and a lot to get through in an hour and a half. So this was an article by Neera Jain in the Coalition Corner, which is a subsection of the Higher Ed and Disability resource. And so for those of you who subscribe, you will have this higher disability compliance in higher education. For those of you who don't but have a library, please know that Wiley is probably covered under your library, and so you can look up this article, and I gave you all the information that you need to look up the article. And then I wanted to briefly talk about some of the modifications. So one would be text-to-speech features on an iPhone or iPad, where the student could text and have the iPad or iPhone do the talking, extended time, short rehearsed statement disclosing their stutter before seeing a patient, pre-notification to preceptors that the student stutters. One of the worst things you can do for someone who stutters is to try to finish their sentences. So just some education around how to work with someone who stutters would be helpful for preceptors. Rehearsing common oral clinical interactions with a standardized patient in the sim lab. So this is almost like systematic desensitization, if you will, putting the student in a situation that simulates what will happen in the clinical setting, and so that they can practice those interactions. Rehearsing for OSCE exams, which are just standardized patient exams. And then, again, using that same badge that we talked about with the student on the spectrum as an outline for patient presentation to help the student focus their speech. And education to the people who are going to work with the student about how stuttering, you know, what stuttering is and what it isn't, and how to work with these individuals. I did want to put a note in there, and I put a link to a YouTube video. Dr. Lena Wen who's a Harvard-trained ER physician, a Rhodes Scholar, and professor. She's a best-selling author as well, but she just took the presidency of Planned Parenthood this last year and a half. Highly successful, and she stuttered all through high school. And so this YouTube video talks about her stuttering, but I put this here as an example to say, you know, physicians who stutter can be very, very successful in the workplace. And I know that I have a physician personally who stutters, and just having the patience to give him time to finish the sentence and not, you know, kind of jumping in and using some of those other helpful tips has been really successful in working with him.
Thank you, Lisa. Is it the responsibility of the school or the individual to purchase these modifications? For example, if the student did not have an iPhone, would the school need to purchase one to use with a cell scope? Or is the onus on the student to purchase modification items for their accommodations request?
So I'll take that one, Mike. So there's several answers to that question. First of all, if it's an access barrier and equipment is needed in the hospital, that's probably something that you as a disability service is going to provide for the student. For example, a student might need a smart pen in taking notes and being able to do it accurately later in the day. And so you would develop a protocol to make sure that smart pen is erased every day and locked up and patient information is protected. And then we look at something that might be a student's personal device, like if they don't have an iPhone. Is the student only going to use it to use the cell scope or the panoptic, or is the student going to use the device as their regular phone? And so if it is going to be a personal device, we know that disability services offices aren't going to purchase that, but they might purchase the cell scope. The other thing to think about is, I know in my situation, we might start off by purchasing a piece of equipment and allowing the student to use it under certain protocols. But then when the student is getting ready to graduate, they want to take it with them. And so we look at how long we've had that device, and then we end up selling it to the student. Otherwise, you would keep devices for the next time you need it with a different student. Next slide.
Thank you, Jan. Are there mechanisms of compliance or enforcement available to students? So our quick answer, there are. But one thing I want to just highlight is that often education will address many of these issues of compliance or failure to provide accommodations. So I want to emphasize that education, both students and also any advocates, mentors, can really be instrumental in addressing many of these. The other thing is, if that's not successful, there are ways to file grievances. And that might be through the Office for Students with Disabilities. Sometimes can help with that. Some places have an ADA office, as well as outside, you can go to the Office for Civil Rights, as well as retaining, basically having access to an attorney for formal litigation. But obviously, those would be sort of a last resource, and hopefully education would be helpful in breaking down many of these barriers. And next slide. What is the best response to a professor concerned about future requirements, particularly in situations where they may use these concerns as a reason to deny accommodations in their current program?
Okay, so...
Yeah, Jan, I believe that's you.
Oh, okay. Sorry, Lisa. Well, in this situation, we want to make sure that we're focusing on program competencies and not really what's going to happen later on. And so we do know that in the real world or in the future workplace, accommodations are going to be available to students that need them or to employees that need them. But at the same time, while the student is in the program, they have to meet core competencies outlined in the program, not what's going to happen later on. So it's really important, again, to know what's in the core competencies for your particular programs. For example, some programs have items such as CPR, CPR licensure or CPR eligible, and that's a part of the core competencies within a specific program that a student has to have that. And so we want to make sure that we're not focusing on we're focusing on what all students have to do, not necessarily what the student with a disability can or cannot do. Next slide.
Thank you, Jan. What is the best way to accommodate a student for one clerkship where they may have to make up a clerkship at a later date without it feeling like a punishment? For example, during their study break, summer break, research opportunities, etc. Again, this is really kind of dependent on each institution, the program, how they're having it set up. So, you know, there's really no one specific answer that can apply to everybody. But obviously, while this is not a punishment, this is really needs to be perceived that we're trying to find the best strategy to make it work. Obviously, there's multiple parties involved with this. But obviously, this is really kind of dependent on the program. And next slide. Our next one is there guidance or suggested resources available for accommodation requests for students with mental health problems like depression and anxiety?
So we have a couple of slides for this because we also get a lot of questions about this. And what I would say is that, you know, if you're having difficulty with somebody that has a psychological disability, if the behavior or the communication or the professionalism is not where it should be, then certainly you need to go back to those technical standards and sit down with a student and explain why they're not meeting the technical standards or, on the flip side, meeting the core competencies, which we have already articulated should include some behavioral standards. But I want to draw back from that and just talk about the things that might occur with the students. You know, a student that has a history of mental health diagnoses or, you know, difficulty, functional limitations may be susceptible to situational stress. So medical school is probably, or nursing school or whatever program, may be the most stressful thing they've ever gone through in their lives. Personally, I think the 1 year, you know, zero to nurse programs that are out there are probably the most stressful programs that exist in health science. So this situational stress may be impacting the student in a way that they won't be impacted on an everyday basis once they graduate. Managing patient workload, you know, be thinking about the patient panel and whether or not the student can mitigate that through accommodations or a reduced patient panel for a limited time. Make sure that your students are situated such that they can attend weekly appointments, that they have release from clinic to do so. This is critical to maintaining well-being. Also, managing triggers. So students can be triggered by a number of things, and it's helpful to talk to your student to find out exactly what is triggering them and then look to see if that is going to be problematic on the wards. Flexibility in the program or course load or order of clinical rotations. For those of you in medicine, making sure that medicine, internal medicine, surgery, and OB-GYN are not situated such that they're one after the other is certainly helpful in helping a student mitigate stress. For some students with psychological disabilities and for students with chronic health disabilities, sometimes decompressing the clinical year into either 2 years or a clinical year and some months can be highly helpful. For those students that have Title IX overlaps, just make sure that you're working with your Title IX office. So unfortunately, we've had incidences where students have been the survivors of sexual harassment or sexual assault on the wards or near the hospital. If that is the case, making sure that you are working closely with your Title IX person is paramount. understand?
So in the next slide, we have a list of standard accommodations that you could consider for someone with a mental health disorder. And one of the easiest things, or one of the a simple thing to consider is depressing the clinical rotation. So if it's a four-week rotation, maybe you look at extending it a little bit. You shorten the amount of time during the day, and then you move it to 6 or 8 weeks. And so what you do is you decrease the hours per day, but then they can make up some of the time on holidays or weekends. Remediating skills without putting remediation on the transcript is really helpful. Looking at housing, some type of alternative housing situation. And then if someone needs to go on a leave of absence, that they're allowed to stay in the program and to stay in housing, keep their health insurance. Financial aid is also something important for you to look at. We know that when students might go on a leave of absence, that it might kick in repayment of loans. And so it's important to know that for at least the first 6 months that they can be not in a repayment mode, but after that they may need to ask for an extension or a forbearance so that they can continue on a leave of absence. Also, they're in the didactic settings. Having time away for appointments or being able to have a private location to do a Skype appointment or a phone appointment, having flexibility in timelines, getting copies of notes, and some of these others are really more standard accommodations for students. So let's go to the next slide and look at some possible clinical accommodations. Again, looking at the placement site. Making sure that this is a site that is accessible for the student in that it is not a place where they have been a patient before or they're receiving treatment, and it's a site that's located in a location where they can still make it to their own appointments. Making sure that there's an allowance to be able to withdraw from a site or to rearrange their current schedule. Doing charting the night before to giving them the opportunity to have a look at patient charts the night before so that they can prepare. Changing from a male or a female preceptor to one that is more helpful in the situation that the student is in, especially if they're a student with PTSD because of sexual assault. You would want to get them in a situation where they had a preceptor that wasn't the perpetrator. Stepping away briefly to care for their personal needs if they need an extra absence, and understanding that they may need to adjust clinical hours if they're going into a significant flare. Regular feedback sessions, again, previewing the site ahead of time is so helpful for our students. Changing the order of rotation can be helpful. Splitting up those very challenging rotations like surgery, orthopedics, OB-GYN, and putting in the easier, shorter rotations in between. And then making sure that students are able to address their sleep hygiene. They might not have overnight call, or they might have a hard stop that they can work into the evenings and stop at 10 o'clock so that they have adequate time to take care of their own personal health. And then making sure that they are able to get their clinical competency at a trauma center at a different location than one that they may have visited as a patient. Next slide.
I'm going to run through, I'm going to skip over the accommodation or leave of absence. I encourage everyone to look at these four slides. They're pretty self-explanatory. It's important to make sure that you understand the best practice for leave of absence and that students aren't being forced to take a leave, but that you also understand the unintended consequences. So I wanted to get back to some of the technical standards questions. And Mike, if you want to go ahead with this question.
Yes. So is there any guidance or resources to develop technical standards for applied healthcare fields? And this is related to occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech language program, speech language pathology, whose technical standards might look a little bit different from medical education.
And we've given you a bunch of articles that talk about developing technical standards. And I know both the Kezar article that is highlighted and the Ailey article that's highlighted, both have examples of technical standards and using the organic versus functional or functional versus organic, as Mike was talking about later. Given the time constraints, we're going to jump forward to the resources. We talked about a centralized, actually, Mike, if you want to read this last question, then we'll talk about the resources that are available.
Yeah, certainly. Is there a centralized toolbox that might describe accommodations for health medical students? Some students may not be sure exactly what to ask for, what supports that are available.
So there are so many supports available for you as disability service providers. And in the next slide, we have the Coalition for Disability Access and Health Science. If you're not a member of the coalition, I want to highly encourage you to look at the benefit of becoming a member. You can become an individual member or an institutional member at a very, very low cost. I think an institutional membership is maybe $125 a year for up to five folks. But through the coalition, you have access to so many colleagues around the nation who are experiencing and having the very same questions that you are. On our website, we have a lot of resources. We have faculty support resources. There are free webinars that you can use for faculty and for training that won't cost anything. And these are trainings that faculty can do on their own, or they can be part of staff meetings. There's other articles that are being added regularly. And so there's quite a few resources there, including Speakers Bureau and training opportunities for your campus. Next slide.
So for your students who are looking for a community to join, the National Medical Accessibility Coalition on Twitter is a great community that was started by students, and it includes trainees from the U.S. and Canada that are advocating for disability access in health professions. So it's at NMAC Tweets, and you can find them on Twitter. Twitter's actually having amazing conversations right now about disability inclusion and health sciences, including the Docs with Disabilities campaign that came out of the University of Michigan Family Medicine Department. And so I have a snapshot here of Docs with Disabilities that if you just search Docs with Disabilities, you see all kinds of discussions and resources. And Mike, do you want to talk about mDisability?
Yes. So mDisability is brandly, it's just a branding of our department program that we have here. And this was newly established just a couple months ago. And Lisa, myself, and also Fermi, a few other individuals who are now our faculty leads. And this department program is really focused on department ways to not only improve the health of people with patients with disabilities, but we will also have a focus on students with disabilities in order to improve access, break down some of the barriers, but also provide pipeline programs. So we are going to be setting up our website very shortly, but we do have our Twitter account right now at disability_UM. So please join us. And lastly, I want to mention the Association of Medical Professionals with Hearing Loss. That's also another great resource, especially for students who have hearing loss. Okay, next slide.
Yeah, AMFL is fantastic. And that's one of the resources listed under the coalition website. Here's just a breakdown of resources that you can use. I do want to point out that all of the resources listed here are completely free, completely accessible. Our goal is to help you get the information you need in a timely manner. And I'm sorry that we had about 20 slides that couldn't be covered. Just very generally, a lot of the questions were about what do you do when your program says you can't do this because of your accrediting body. Go to the accrediting website and look at the language. The slides that I have in there have excerpts of language, but you still have to follow federal guidelines. So make sure that if your department is giving you pushback about accreditation, that you go and actually look at what the accrediting body says about disability. As always, it's such a pleasure to have Great Lakes provide this additional free resource for you that's fully accessible, and it just makes me so happy to have these resources out there. I think making sure that people know about them is critical. The 20-minute trainings for faculty, there's the link, and the AAMC webinars on disability, which is applicable to all health science. But all of these are centralized right now really quickly at the coalition website, and so that's a great place to start. It's great that you're asking these questions. It's great that the needle is moving really far over the last 4 years. And so we appreciate the work that you're doing. You're in the trenches doing this work every day, and we want to provide support and resources for you to continue to do such a great job. It's always a pleasure to speak to disability service providers. And as always, if you have questions, feel free to reach out to us. I'm sorry that we couldn't get to every question. This is just one of those, you know, constant struggles when there's something new and we have lots of questions to answer. But know that there are lots of resources. That guide to assisting students with disabilities, although it's not listed here, it's available now, and the second edition is actually coming out in 2020. So there'll be lots and lots and lots of resources for you.
Excellent, excellent. Thank you all very much, Lisa, Mike, Jan. What a wealth of information you have just provided to us. A quick reminder that the handout for the PowerPoint that was used will be posted with the archive, so you will have access to all of the information and all of the great resources that our speakers put together for you. Real quickly, our next ADA audio conference session will be on June 25th. Please note the date. It is going to be the fourth Tuesday of the month instead of the third Tuesday. We will be looking at effective communication. What does that mean? You can get that information. You can access the archive from today's session along with the handout when that becomes available by visiting ada-audio.org. Thanks again to our speakers. Thanks to all of you for joining us. Have a great day and take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude today's presentation. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.